There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at DecodingTV.com. Become a paid member, get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, as well as bonus episodes. Thanks to everyone who's a paid member at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
Right, you miserable, sniveling, festering rags. I have a feeling this is the one.
You
go.
Just keep that between you and I.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I am David Chen. Joining me, as always, Patrick Klepek. How's it going today, man?
David, you just keep asking me, what are we going to talk about next week? And I just have to respond, why tell a dead man the future?
Anyway, wow, bleak.
Could today be a metaphorical death, you know. It doesn't have to be literal, David. You take that however you want about your current life circumstances.
Wow, okay. This is Patrick Klepek. If I die this week, it's going to look very suspicious for you, okay? Anyway, you can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com and find us across all platforms at Decoding TV. Instagram, we're on Threads, we're on YouTube, we're on TikTok, for as long as that's still around. Today on the podcast, it's a packed episode today, okay? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff we're going to cover today. We're going to start with a little bit of TV news, but really we're going to be discussing three big shows. We're going to talk about The Jinx, Part 2, we're going to talk about The Sympathizer, and we're going to talk about the season finale of Shogun. So there's so much to get to. Let's dive into it. You know, let's just dive right in because we don't have much time. And the Shogun conversation, I'm just going to call this out right now, is probably going to last a little long. So we will start by talking about Fallout, the Amazon original series. Fallout has been renewed for season 2 by Amazon. This is not a big surprise because the show, by all accounts, seems to be massively popular and well-liked. We certainly enjoyed it here on Decoding TV when we discussed it. And we will be covering it in a future week's episode of the podcast. Patrick Klepek, were you excited to hear this news? None of us have seen the season finale yet as of this watching, right?
Correct.
You're really far along the show. I'm almost there as well. So we don't know how it ends. We don't know if we're like really rearing for an episode, season 2. But Patrick, I think you've seen 7 out of the 8 episodes at this point, right? Are you excited for a season 2 of Fallout?
I am. You know, I don't want to preview too much of our thoughts in the entire season before we get to that conversation, but it's a strong season, and it's funny, in an industry, this is true of video games as well as movies and television, where it's difficult to tell, like, is this successful? We talk about this with 3-body problem a lot. Like,
yeah,
how do we know if this is a success? And the reason you know Fallout's a success is not just that it was a buzzy show that you can like tell lots of people are talking about. Like, you're seeing memes, people are calling the ghoul sexy, a lot of sort of abstract sort of idea. Like, how can you tell, like, if you put a finger to the wind, like, how can you tell if something is hitting? But it's all anecdotal. With Fallout, like, the video games associated with Fallout are seeing record numbers of players of interest. Fallout 76, which is an online Fallout game, Fallout 4, Fallout 3, like Nexus Mods, which is a repository where people download modifications made by fans of not just Fallout, but all sorts of games, has had to get increased server capacity because Fallout fans are just descending on their website to get these fan-based mods, which are very popular in the Fallout games. And so the consequences of the Fallout show have been enormous and suggest a show that is not just big, but is a mega hit, like the kinds of which that we just do not see very often.
Like, it's so successful that it's impacting the success of the property in a completely different medium, basically.
Correct.
Right. And I saw it's like hundreds of thousands of concurrent players, which is really good for a game this old. I saw an article in Windows Central. I was curious what you thought of this, Patrick Klepek, that was saying how one of the problems is that there's no new Fallout games. going to be releasing anytime in the near future. So it's like they have all this surge of interest into these old games, but nothing to capitalize on it. What did you think about that, Patrick Lippert?
There, that may not stay true for long. There has been,
right.
do not aggregate me, please. I'm not telling you this is happening, but there has been long running credible rumors that Fallout 3 is going to get not just a, you know, an update that makes it look snazzier, but a full on remake. And, you know, if you are to trade, like, obviously the Fallout.
Hold on, threading this out right now on Threads, Patrick Klepek reports Fallout 3 remake. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
And the Bethesda, the studio responsible for Fallout 3, Fallout 4, Fallout 76, really like have brought Fallout into like how we conceptualize it. You know, sort of in the modern age, a post Fallout 1 and 2, which are sort of 90s computer RPGs, the games they make, whatever you think about Starfield or even Fallout 4, which was a game that I was pretty mixed on, they take a long time. Their process is very deliberate and slow. And the kinds of games they make with the scale and production of games these days, it can take 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years to produce one of them. And so revisiting essentially like the core, does like the foundation of the Fallout television show, Fallout 3, if that was able to come out, you know, sometime between now and season 2, which would arrive probably sometime in the next, you know, 18 to 24 months, I think that would be an enormous deal. So I'm rooting for that to happen, but it is also genuinely shocking that we live in a synergistic age and all that Microsoft and Bethesda could kind of scrounge together for this television show, maybe they didn't think it was going to be as good or as big of a hit as it has been. That's not the first time stuff like this has happened. Sometimes this stuff does take people by surprise, but the most they could sort of muster was some like in-game cosmetics for Fallout 76 and sales for games that are frankly ancient at this point. So
right,
I'm rooting
right.
for that remake to happen because of the modern Fallout games, New Vegas aside, 3 is my favorite, and I would really like a chance to revisit it. So I'm
if you're listening and you were to try to play 3 right now, you know it's still a very good game, but it is very old game. Yeah.
There's a reason they invented the VAT system, which is essentially a way to incorporate turn-based combat into a real-time shooting game. So in Fallout 3, you can basically tap a button and
right.
you'll see percentage markers on different body parts, and it slows the game down really slow. And you spend a lot of time in that because if you spend time out of it, you actually have to shoot a gun, which does not feel good in Fallout 3
right.
because the studio that built that Bethesda did not make like games with guns before that.
Right.
And
it is,
if there's something that games are good at, for better or worse, it is making feeling a gun and shooting it feel real damn good. And it does not feel great to do that in Fallout 3.
Indeed. Anyway, looking forward to season 2 of Fallout, and we will see how the video game stuff develops, given how popular the show has been. But yeah, I don't know that the Halo TV show created a massive wave of interest in Halo. Do you know what I'm saying? And so like
no.
maybe they just thought, hey, this might be like that, not knowing that they had, they had lightning in a bottle here with the Fallout TV show. So. One other piece of TV news to mention, Old Boy TV series in the works from filmmaker Park Chan-wook. According to The Hollywood Reporter, Korean filmmaker Park Chan-wook is partnering with Lionsgate Television to develop a series version of his 2003 revenge thriller, Old Boy. The project would be an English language adaptation of the story, which was loosely based on a manga of the same name, end quote. Patrick Klepek, I don't know that we've spoken about Old Boy, you and me, but I mean, I consider this movie a classic. This movie, Old Boy, was released in theaters recently. I went to go see it. You know, that's how much of a fan I am. I have the original Tartan Blu-ray of Old Boy. Like, I'm a big fan of this movie. I think it still holds up. It's still an incredible achievement. I also have no idea why they keep trying to remake Old Boy.
Yeah, out of respect, out of spite, I just never saw the remake, despite the fact that like
Spike Lee, very talented
many
director,
respectable people were involved in it. I was like, none of this makes sense. It's been years since I've done, showing Old Boy to somebody that doesn't know what happens in Old Boy is one of the all delightful. Time. It's delightful. Just like the it's whole wonderful. Time, like trying to hold the belly laugh in, like, ha 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 ha. What a fun, what a fun adventure we're about to all go on in this film. I mean, I haven't watched it. I know it's cruel. It's such a mean thing to do to people. Although I saw Neon, who I think is responsible for distributing Old Boy these days, out here doing some questionable relationship tweets about Old Boy in a way that is like, if you don't know what Old Boy is. Anyway, I desperately need to revisit that movie at some point, because it's probably been a decade since I've watched it.
I will tell you that you should definitely watch the new release. In my opinion, one of the biggest changes this recent re-release makes, other than it looks very good, is the, from what I can recall, the translation for the subtitles is completely different. And much better. Like the original translation, there was a bunch of stuff that I thought was really opaque and difficult to understand. This new translation is like, wow, it is art. Like this new
when
translation.
When did that movie come out originally?
The original film came out in 2003, so over 20 years ago.
Yeah, it was a poor localization, but I also think we've had such a sea change in how we treat
right, yeah,
foreign
yeah, yeah.
films.
Well, it's
subtitles.
A completely different company, and you know, Neon. It's a completely different company handling this release now. So it's
sure. But I just mean in general. I think culturally speaking, yes. We care much more about that stuff, and I think it
right,
would not
before,
shock me.
Before you were lucky if it was comprehensible, right? Like,
right, you're getting more of a machine buying, machine.
Right, when you're buying a DVD off of a really sketchy place in Chinatown, like you're lucky if you can understand what's actually happening. Now, yeah, you're right. Like Netflix invested many millions of dollars into like making sure there's multiple languages, you know, multiple dubs of most of their original properties. So it certainly is something we treat better now. But yeah, I don't know, man. You already made a masterpiece the first time around. You know, like you don't need to redo it in a different way. Like, is there that much more story to tell is the question. I don't know if there is. And maybe the TV show will prove me wrong. Patrick Klepek, you excited about this?
If you were going to do it, if you were going to revisit the story, I'd rather you did it. Like, I don't think you should do it at all. Like, that's sort of baseline. It's just never a story that I felt a compulsion that this is a world that needs to be revisited and expanded upon. But, like, if there are two doors in front of you, and one is remaking it versus telling, like, an expanded
right.
story in television, yes. I'm more interested in watching that, especially with the original creative involved. Like,
yes.
Maybe it's just a check for them. I have no idea. But just on a baseline, what has a better chance of being interesting?
Yeah.
I think a TV show has a better chance of being interesting than something trying to, because at that point, you can't chase the movie. You're using its like foundational pieces to tell a story, but by sheer like volume of storytelling that has to appear, you are forced to do something different within the show,
yeah.
which I didn't watch the remake, but my understanding was that it mostly felt like it was chasing the original film with new actors.
I thought it was pretty bad. I watched the remake. I didn't think it was very good. And it felt like, oh, this is just Old Boy, but in English.
Right.
And not
right.
as good.
Right.
Kind of.
Right.
You know, that's kind of how it felt. And so I agree with you that this, you know, I'm glad he's not just remaking the movie in English. I'm glad that Park Chan-wook is involved. I think he's a visionary director. But I'm skeptical. And if you want to see a really good form of this story, it is available right now. You can buy it on digital. It's distributed by Neon. It is a very, very good version of the story. So I would definitely check it out. But for now, skeptical. That said, Park Chan-wook, one of my favorite directors. And so I am always excited to see what he's going to come up with. We'll see how this ends up. All right, one last bit of TV news I wanted to mention. You know, last week on the podcast, Patrick Klepek, I said, hey, Patrick Klepek, I'm going to predict that there's not going to be any more Bluey episodes. Set your watch to that prediction. It's going to be a movie night. It's going to be something more ambitious. It's going to be a theme park ride. Turns out I was incredibly wrong almost immediately, right? Like, I think that's one of the fastest times my predictions have been proven wrong. There was a new Bluey episode out this last week, right?
There was back to its original format of short form storytelling. Yeah. There was an episode called Surprise, which I read about 2 days before it came out. There was mumblings that it was going to hit, and I kept it as a surprise to my kids so that when they were scrolling through to watch The Sign for the seventh time, there all of a sudden, I mean, my oldest was She does know how to swear. She knows she's not supposed to. She got awfully close to swearing, to being like, holy shit, there's another Bluey episode, and came running in to so that we could all sit to watch it. I don't want to say a thing about what happens. Both the sign and the new episode surprise do gesture at, honestly, different paths the storytelling could go down. It almost feels like the storytellers themselves are laying out different ideas, frameworks, ways of even thinking about episodic construction can go, or storytelling construction can go, kind of putting this all on the table, both for the audience and for themselves to sort of think through, we could do it that way, we could do it that way. Like, here are the different, if we think about these characters this way, or we could completely recontextualize them, which is the most I'll say about surprise, like this way. They're all really interesting, and it makes me fascinated to see whether they've already made that choice, and this is them just kind of outlining, here's creatively how we've been thinking through this, and then when they reveal this is what we plan to do, it'll kind of all make sense. But it's I think it's a fascinating insight into the creative process, which is not something you usually get with a lot of episodic television, just given the sheer length and time it takes to produce it. To have the creatives here be so open about, we're not sure what the next phases are for this show, even though it's at its height of popularity, it's just really interesting. And surprise is really good. So the quality bar has remained.
I also think it's just kind of amusing watching this as a kind of Bluey outsider, that there's a show that you just don't know when the next episode is going to drop. Where, you know, most of the time when Patrick and I review something, it's like, oh, Shogun has 10 episodes, you know, The Sympathizers has 7 episodes. The finale is going to air on this day. You know, Bluey, apparently no one knows anything about what's happening. It's just like people just wandering around, like hoping a new episode drops, which is, I think, kind of funny.
It does have the, I haven't read enough about the production process, but I know you do get the sense sometimes that it feels like someone's like, all right, it's done. Upload it. Like, just drag the MP4 like onto the Disney Plus servers. And it just like, that's how fast. I'm sure it is not as goofy as that, but the fact it showed, like, the surprise aspect of it, I have to say, is part of the fun of watching it, which feels very different and disconnected from the way so much other television. It puts a certain amount of faith in the audience, degree, to be like, hey, we're not gonna be, I mean, they did, you know, signpost The Sign, because that was a big deal. They were treating it almost like the equivalent of a film, but everything else is just sort of, maybe there's something new for you. And that's just, in a world where it's hard to fight through the noise, to have the confidence that, oh, we'll just quietly drop something new and know that the audience will find it, is really neat.
Indeed. All right, well, those are a couple of pieces of TV news for you this week.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
We are now going to get to the part of the show where we talk about specific television episodes that have been airing recently. I also want to let people, we're going to talk about The Jinx, Season 2, Part 1. We're going to talk about the first two episodes of The Sympathizer, Park Chan-wook's new TV series that's airing right now on Max, the one to watch for HBO. And we are going to talk about the season finale of Shogun. Next week, we're going to be covering Fallout Season 1, the entire season. We're going to talk about the whole show and what we thought of it, including spoilers for the finale. And we are going to plan to cover The Sympathizer further as well. So that is what you should prep for next week if you want to continue joining us for what we're covering right here on Decoding TV All that said, Patrick Klepek, let's talk about The Jinx Season 2.
As The Jinx aired, Bob and I spoke after every episode. He was very nervous. And I thought to myself, he's going to run.
My captain told me, whatever you do, don't let Robert Durst get away.
Bob is going to flee the country, never to return. And of course, that didn't happen.
Patrick Klepek, let's talk about The Jinx Season 2, which is streaming right now, and Max is the one to watch for HBO. In 2015, the nation became transfixed by The Jinx, the life and deaths of Robert Durst. Heir to the New York City real estate magnate Seymour Durst, Robert Durst was connected to the deaths and disappearances of three separate people. The unsolved disappearance of his ex-wife, Kathleen McCormick, in 1982, the murder of his longtime friend Susan Berman in 2000, and the 2001 murder of his neighbor Morris Black. The Jinx documentary, Part 1, Season 1, was electrifying, mostly because director Andrew Jarecki managed to convince Robert Durst to appear on camera talking about the killings. Durst was a bizarre figure, and the whole show was a compelling spectacle as you wondered why Durst would potentially implicate himself by agreeing to talk so extensively about his life. During the production of the show, Susan Berman's stepson discovered a letter written by Robert Durst that contained the same typo as an anonymous letter sent to police telling them where Susan Berman's body was. It was a spectacular moment when Robert Durst was confronted with this information, right? They showed the handwriting on an anonymous letter saying where this dead woman's body was, and then a separate letter that Robert Durst wrote, and the handwriting was identical. And they presented Robert Durst with this information, and he couldn't identify which one was his and which one wasn't. Amazing television. This spectacular moment, and also just the handwriting evidence in general, helped lead to Durst's arrest, which took place on the eve that The Jinx finale aired. The Jinx is back with another six-part season covering the events that transpired between 2015 and now, surrounding Durst's conviction and imprisonment. Only the first episode has aired at the time that we're recording this. Both Patrick Klepek and I have seen it. Patrick, do you think The Jinx Season 2 is worth watching?
Do you want to have your intelligence insulted for about an hour and sign yourself up for the kink of watching The Jinx? Do you want to watch a documentarian masturbate for an hour about his own successes? Well, then sign up for The Jinx Part 2.
The Jinx Part 2 is kind of like the hand-making jerk-off motion
in
documentary form.
Insufferable. I cannot believe there are six episodes of this. Go away.
Okay, so both Patrick Klepek and I are like a big no on this show.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, Patrick, did you like The Jinx Season 1? I thought it was incredible at the time that I watched it, right?
Everything you just laid out. And it comes before or like in the midst of this big cultural true crime pivot,
right?
Like the obsession that has now gripped, a lot of our culture in podcast form, in document, like the rise of documentaries as entertainment, like is happening alongside like The Jinx dropping. And I think The Jinx, even still on its own, is a sort of an anomaly in its access in the revelations. I forgot that he was arrested leading up
before the finale, right?
Cannot script something more delicious if you are a filmmaker that is trying to not just juice interest in what you've created, but just that's just drama. And so it was appointment television. It was a remarkable feat of filmmaking. And so that's what made me so curious about, well, why come back to this? And it's also the struggle with a lot of these things, which is that these documentaries, these true crime documentaries, they package up everything, though, including the revelations. But once it's out there, like the snowball starts taking place in public. And it seems very difficult to do a sequel to something where what you've put out there is now manifesting in real time in Reddits, in other social media spaces. And so it's like, well, then what is this second season about? And,
I was going to ask, I wrote discussion questions to prepare for, and one of them was, do we think the show is worth watching for people who have not seen the first season? I don't think so. I think we think the show is not worth watching at all.
Yeah.
But certainly without the context of the first season, I don't think it will make much sense. And really, again, season one was really compelling because it had the guy on camera. Here, they don't have the guy on camera, probably because the first time he was on camera, it ended disastrously for him. And so he's like, I don't want to do that again, right? And so they instead have to use like interviews with people who know him and other footage they're able to get of him. Like he's in prison making phone calls. They were able to get the camera footage of him making phone calls in prison. But like he's not on camera anymore. And so it's like, why does this exist? You know, now, to be fair, there are 6 episodes of this and we've only seen the first one. We've also read reviews of people who've seen the first 4. And maybe there's going to be some massive revelation that drops in the final 2 episodes that are, they'll be like, oh, this justifies why this show was made. But so far, it's basically covering all the stuff that happened after the Jinx, much of which you can very easily see and read online, right? And which is just really less interesting than the stuff that happened in the first season. So,
one thing I would say is to flip around the question of should you watch this, the second arc, if you haven't seen the first. But if you haven't watched the Jinx, but you know like a decent chunk of what happened, the consequences because of cultural osmosis, is it worth watching the original Jinx? I would say yes. I know that you've talked a lot about, you've watched a lot more documentaries, true crime stuff than I have, but I know a through line in the way you've talked about it has been, you know, like what is additive about the documentary versus just reading a good news article or a Wikipedia entry.
Or watching a YouTube video, right? And and it's like, they have the guy on camera. He is a compelling figure. He's a weird dude. And they have him on camera talking about it. And actually, that's one of the components of why the documentary is interesting, because he's the kind of guy, he's almost like Elon Musk-esque in the sense that he likes to feel like he's alive. And one of the ways he does that is by subjecting himself to danger by doing things like being part of the Jinx.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is worth watching. Now that said, Patrick Klepek, I need to ask your journalistic opinion on this.
Oh. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Jinx season 2 makes copious references to the original season of the Jinx and the impact of it. There's been some controversy around the ending of the Jinx season 1. During the finale of the Jinx season 1, this is a legendary moment in TV history, in my opinion. Robert Durst has done the interview where he's been presented with this terrible handwriting evidence, and then he goes into the bathroom and the mic is still on. And he keeps talking. And
it's very easy to do that, by the way. I do not have experience with a lav mic or you can tell people to remote mute you, but you are supposed to, like, there's a hard switch on like the box that's attached to it that is usually put in the pocket, like a back pocket or front pocket of your pants, and you are supposed to like click that, usually because they don't want to, the control room doesn't want to hear you piss and shit. Like that's usually what that, like, people are getting up to go to the bathroom and they don't want to hear you like do your business. But I want to say, like, it is remarkably easy to like, oh, time to go to the bathroom, and like have someone yell at you, turn off your mic. Like it's very easy to do.
I thought you were going to say it's very easy to do because Patrick Klepek is also used to confessing his crimes on a microphone.
No, I do. I don't need to go to a bathroom to do that. Like, I go into the stall known as Decoding TV.
Yes.
And I just upload everything here.
That is correct. Okay. Anyway, on the mic, he said, "What have I done? Killed them all, of course." Now, I actually have the audio as it was presented in the episode. So this is not the whole audio. This is just an excerpt. But this is how, this is an excerpt as it was aired on HBO 10 years ago.
Kill them all, of course.
He says, "What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course." Right? Now, when this aired, it was shocking. And also, if you type in on Google, because I know I did this, "killed them all," literally it will autofill, of course, because it was like a legendary line. It's like, oh my God, the smoking gun. Now, I think that's a little bit silly because he said a bunch of random shit in the bathroom, and I don't know about you. Sometimes I say weird stuff, you know, when I'm by myself. Like, I'm not saying it was like I think he's guilty, but I'm just saying, like, I don't know that him random sayings he said in and of themselves constitute like smoking gun evidence. And that viewpoint got considerably more backing when it was revealed during the trial that the filmmakers had edited the audio so that the statements took place in a different order. The actual transcript of what he said, I'm just going to read the transcript of what he says, okay, in the bathroom. Because this had to be submitted to evidence, because the criminal justice system has higher standards of truth than HBO documentaries. Quote, "I don't know what you expected to get. I don't know what's in the house. Oh, I want this. Killed them all, of course. I want to do something new. There's nothing new about that. He was right. I was wrong. The burping. I'm having difficulty with the question. What the hell did I do?" End quote. Right? Like, that is the actual... So, yes, killed them all, of course. That's damning. But he's saying a bunch of other random shit, right?
Yeah, like, it just sounds like a Mad Libs of, like, a guy not right. quite on the ball.
So when you... So then when you edit it to say, "What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course." I think it makes it sound way more damning than the actual audio is. Patrick Klepek, you are a journalist. How do you feel about what Andrew Jarecki did on the season finale of The Jinx?
It seems pretty egregious. Even if the original language there, the original quote, like, I think if the Jinx, if it had left that in, maybe it doesn't hit with the same hammer, but I think it still would have.
There's no maybe about it. There's no maybe about it. It definitely wouldn't hit in the same way.
Right.
Anyway.
But to when you are conducting an interview and then you are editing quotes, there you actually have kind of multiple responsibilities that you are juggling. For example, if you are editing a quote, transcribing it, and putting it into a piece, sometimes you do selective editing to make sure that when something is said audibly out loud and you hear it, you don't pick up on people saying, like, you know, that just kind of can filter through your ears a little bit. Right. And so oftentimes I'm looking at a quote and I'll realize, oh, hey, this person has a speech pattern. This phrasing is not additive to the sentence. They are repeating this over and over because that is just how they speak. I'm going to take this out so that this quote flows better, so that what they're trying to say is like comes across better. There are other times where, let's say, a quote is exceptionally long and I'm trying to bridge two ideas together. You will snip out part of that quote. You are deleting part of the quote so it is not from A to B. And then oftentimes you will put in, like, in brackets and a dot, dot, dot. And that signifies to the reader that an edit has occurred. But like, I have made a conscious choice as the journalist to remove part of this this conversation so that these ideas bridge together. And you're just sort of supposed to trust that I have done right by you and I'm not trying to mislead you. And so there is a lot of ample documentaries are not like objective. Like journalists, when they're writing pieces, are not fully objective. You are doing subjective editorializing in quotes you pick, how you frame them, what parts of it you pick apart. And then the question becomes, you know, what happened here? It went into a court of law. The full like cards were laid out on the table, and I think what you found was there was the selective editing that occurred here seems to have been done in bad faith to produce a more explosive outcome, as opposed to trying to make a point and doing your best with the original work to emphasize that point and not be misleading. And I think what you take ire with, which I think is totally reasonable, is that selective editing went far, like went into it wasn't about making a point. It was about being misleading to have an impact. And I think that is a totally reasonable reaction to have.
I mean, I think what you're pointing to very, very reasonably is like, it is okay to edit interviews sometimes, right? It is okay to edit interviews if it helps you to better represent what the person actually said. Now, according to the New York Times piece about this very controversy, quote, "The filmmakers defend their edits as being entirely representative of what Mr. Durst said," end quote. So they think that that's what they were doing. They're like,
and that's,
hey,
that's the subjectivity of from the journalist's or the documentarian's perspective is you are making these choices all the time. I think here it is like pretty blatantly obvious that it was meant to be an exclamation mark on like this important moment in the show. And you can make those mistakes, but boy, like the consequences of this one, it feels like one of those things where in the edit bay, it just got away. Like they just fell into their own trap, right? Like they were just seduced by like how explosive this could be. And you start moving things around. And like you end up in this version of it and you're like, well, it's not untrue.
Depending
on your point of view. So I'm not trying to be overly sympathetic. I just, it's a process that you can get wrong. That's usually why you have editors that are checking, you know, like what is the process that happened after this that asked questions about why do it this way? And my understanding is also these creator, like the documentarian, canceled interviews post finale. He could have been scrutinized, asked about like, how did we arrive here? And like that broadly, that kind of interrogation broadly has not occurred about the creative side of creating this documentary series.
I want to follow up on that, but before I do, I just want to say, what he said in the original transcript is a bunch of random shit, then the phrase killed them all, of course, then a bunch of random shit, and then what the hell did I do? When you take what the hell did I do and put that right before killed them all, of course, I believe that is being misleading. Now, that said, I did post on this on Threads this last week, which is still a weird thing. I don't like saying that phrase. It makes me feel bad. But I did post on Threads about this, and I think there are a lot of people who defend what Andrew Jarecki did. And they say, hey, like, it is completely representative of what he said. There's a lot of people. And so you listening might feel that way, but that is not how I feel. I think it is editing the footage to be mislead. It's editing the audio to be misleading. And that was very disappointing to me when I learned about that. Patrick Klepek, if only there was an entire season of television dedicated to the aftermath of the Jinx through which to one could explore this question, right? That would be really interesting to hear, hey, why did you edit it in this way? Like, what was the justification behind that decision? I don't think we're going to get any of that introspection on this show, Patrick Levy. Here's why I think that is because in the first episode, there is footage of the victims of Robert Durst viewing the season finale of the Jinx. And that is compelling. You know, it's compelling to see. Again, it does further cement
Isn't that
this.
Weird, though? Like, I was profoundly uncomfortable.
Tell me why you thought that was weird. I think it's interesting. I'm like, part of me is like, why? What is this show I'm watching that you're just kind of being like, wasn't the Jinx awesome? That's kind of what most of the show is, right? But I thought it was actually compelling to see. The point I was going to make was that notably, they didn't show that whole sequence of him saying all that stuff. They just showed the phrase "killed them all," of course. So he's like, he didn't want to relive the whole controversy again. So he just showed "killed them all," of course, in the replay. But why did it make you uncomfortable, Patrick Levy?
Well, that takes place at the documentarian's like house, right? It was a like private like inviting of. And look, I've done really sensitive stories that involved sexual assault, sexual harassment. Like, it is impossible not to become close, form a relationship with victims in stories where you're dealing with extremely sensitive information. I guess maybe the existence of a viewing party, the fact that it was a surprise, I don't know, like the idea that it was like, I've invited all of you here, like in theory, victims of Robert Durst, to see this little surprise I've made for you. Like, this is the finale of my documentary. It feels like an insensitive way to handle what should be catharsis for like these victims, which is validation of what they've been talking about, their feelings for it. And I can't speak for these victims. Like, they obviously don't voluntarily. I think it felt especially icky contextualized in the broader package of the episode, which was celebratory.
I can understand if it's like, hey, I'm going to invite you all here for this finale, and also I'm going to convert that into new content. Like, that That I understand why that's objectionable. But like the act of just inviting them all, I think that's completely fine. Because it's like, hey, this is something they're clearly invested in. And yeah, they
I think it's in the context of the whole episode, which feels very congratulatory.
Yes.
And seems to be like, look how great I am. Like, look what we like. And it's just, it feels icky. And so I think,
look at what I made. To quote Shogun. Yeah.
Yes. And it makes me look at, why were those people invited? Why did you do that? You know what I mean? Like, it makes me question the motives of everything else because of the way it's juxtaposed, but the way it's contextualized in this episode. So on its face, I can certainly see why you would invite the people featured in the work that you probably spent years doing. Here's the final bit. I think you will find it emotionally satisfying and informative. I don't take issue with that on its face. I think the reason it rubbed the wrong way was because, like, the documentarian and the self-serving nature of this first episode makes me look at that as like, well, why did you do that? Like, who was this for?
Yeah. No, that's a great point. It's a great point. But yeah, that's what most of this episode is. It's like, wasn't The Jinx great? Wow, what a groundbreaking show The Jinx was. That's what season two of The Jinx has been so far.
It feels like an epilogue, right? If you told me this was something that came 18 months after the airing of the first season and was like, hey, we followed some of the threads. Like, here's what's kind of happened afterwards. Like, but nothing about this suggests to me I need to watch.
Right.
Like, what's the season arc? Like, what am I watching?
Right. Right. It feels like a DVD special feature for the season one.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And Robert Durst looks like he couldn't even open a jar of jam right now. Like, it's not, there's no tension. They try to make it like, oh, he's going to flee. Look at the dude walking around. He's like shuffling, man. Like, he's that. I think his killing days are behind him. My guess. Who knows? Maybe he'll kill again, and then I'll feel bad about this. But like, the show tries to milk this tension out of like, oh, is he gonna get out of here? Like, is he gonna flee the country? You know, it's like the dude can barely walk from point A to point B. Like, I don't know how successful you're gonna be at generating suspense from this. That said, Patrick Klepek, I regret to inform you, I am going to be watching this show.
Well, yeah, but you're watching it for a different reason, which is...
Despite everything I've just said, I'm going to watch it because I feel like I need to finish the story, and I'm also, you know, really into documentaries and true crime. And even though I think this whole season is a Travis Shaw mockery, I do think I will probably continue watching. However, we will not be covering it more on this Decoded TV.
Well, you will have to, but when it wraps up, I do not think I'm going to go with this on this journey with you, unless at some point you say there is a compelling reason to. But we should
even then,
it.
Even then, I think I'm just going to be like, maybe in a subsequent episode he will address the editing controversy. I doubt it. Maybe in a subsequent episode there will be something big, but like, so far it doesn't look like any of that stuff is on tap, and I don't expect that will change too much. If it does, maybe I'll mention it. But so far, it's been a really weak showing for The Jinx season two. So those are our thoughts on that TV show. And we do not plan to cover it any further here on Decoding TV. All right. Patrick Klepek, let's talk about The Sympathizer.
Biracial. Bilingual. That was a synthesis of incompatibilities. So what did I do?
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Get down!
Saigon, 1975. I was a man of two faces.
You are the only one I can trust.
The war was ending.
Yo!
And I awaited my new assignment.
My protege.
Jesus.
So where are we going?
To next harbor on your CIA voyage, America.
All right, let's talk about The Sympathizer right here on Decoding TV. The Sympathizer is based on Viet Thanh Nguyen's Pulitzer Prize-winning book. It is co-showrun by Don McKellar and legendary auteur-director Park Chan-wook, who also directs several of the episodes. It stars Robert Downey Jr. playing four separate roles. And Hoa Zwande plays a Vietnamese double agent who is called just the captain in the show. It doesn't have a name. There are going to be seven episodes of The Sympathizer. The first two have already aired. The episode titles are Death Wish and Good Little Asian. Patrick Klepek and I have seen both the first two episodes. Patrick, do you think people should watch the show?
I think they should. I think you should watch at least the first two episodes if as we'll get into, the first didn't fully work for you, but I think the second is really interesting. And
for me.
And the two principal leads, right? Like Hoizuande and Robert Downey Jr. are just doing fascinating work. It's a fascinating show, is what I what I'll say.
Yeah, yeah. I think people should watch the show. I actually think it's incredible. You know, I said it was almost Shogun level in my opinion. I don't think you shared that opinion, but I think it's really, really good and worth checking out. So anyway, let's talk about some more overall thoughts. This show chronicles the exploits of a half French, half Vietnamese communist double agent who infiltrates Southern Vietnam and is eventually exiled to Los Angeles, along with the Vietnamese general he is meant to be spying on. In the first two episodes we viewed, we see the captain's challenges negotiating his loyalties in Vietnam. He tries to spy on his general on behalf of the communists, evade detection for his covert activities, even as he tries to save his friend's family's life by getting them on a plane, leaving Vietnam before the fall of Saigon. In the second episode, the captain receives a scholarship to a Los Angeles university, but continues his work surveilling the general, who initially seems like he's losing his mind, but eventually opens a liquor store with a resolve to root out a spy in his group of refugees. So, Patrick Klepek, let's start with this. The show and the book are billed as a black comedy historical drama. I'm curious, how did the mix of tones work for you? Because we don't see many black comedy historical dramas. This is actually, when we think of Vietnam, I think a lot of people have very upsetting associations with that war, like the imagery, the image of America, the actual atrocities that were committed, like a lot of negative associations. But yet the show tries to be kind of lighthearted, kind of tongue in cheek in parts. Does it work for you tonally?
I don't think it did. Or maybe I just had trouble settling in to what it was presenting to me in the first episode. I think that's was a huge part of my ambivalence coming out of episode one, was just
it's a weird show. It's
weird. What am I watching?
Right,
and you're like, it's the performances are simultaneously extremely subtle and wildly over the top. You have characters, you have actors who feel like they're being very nuanced, and then you have others that are chewing scenery. Like I'm in some sort of B movie. Like a lot of Robert Downey Jr.'s work here is the scene chewing, as well as it's done. And it's just, I just came out the end of it being like, I don't know what the fuck I just watched. And I think the sooner you get on the frequency of this show, if you can tune yourself to it, which I just didn't quite get there by the end, especially, again, you mentioned all the comedy elements, like the end of the first episode is as sad as it is. There's nothing funny about what's happening anymore. And I just found it very difficult to jump on the show's wavelength. And it wasn't I don't know if it was just a little more time. I don't know if because the show settles down a little bit. I don't know if it was the changing to a more familiar setting in the United States. I don't know which one of those elements, how they all came together. By the time we get to the second episode, I found myself vibing with what it was presenting and able to do the tonal shifts much more effortlessly as the viewer. So I can't speak to if I was to sit back and rewatch that first episode again, which I've been tempted to, would I find myself enjoying it a lot more because I sort of know what I'm in for? But I really do think it's the kind of thing that if you are iffy on that first episode because of the wild tonal shifts, which is part of what I find interesting about your reaction to it, because, you know, not to brush with a broad stroke, but tonal whiplashes often seem like something that don't always work with you or something that you have a lot of irritation with in a lot of different works. And so this show is doing tonal whiplash all the time.
Yes.
So it just made it difficult for me to settle into it. And by the time that second episode finished, I was happy and ready to see where exactly this show was going to go next.
I think one of the things I really appreciate about Park Chan-wook's work, he's the director, a co-executive producer on the show, right? Is his films often have a propulsive nature to them. They move forward with great urgency. And what ends up happening is the audience feels like they need to catch up with him, right? You're dropped into the situation. There's a narrator. You're in this time period. You're flashing back and forth in time rapidly, like in the first episode, it becomes less pronounced in the second episode, but it's still happening, right? And as the audience, you're just like, oh, what's happening? I need to keep up. And I'm barely keeping up with what's happening in the show. And I think that helps me to overlook a lot of the tonal imbalances, is because, like, oh, like a person made a joke about some horrifying atrocity. Like, before I can even think about that and be upset about it, we're already on to the next. It's like cut to 4 months in the future. Okay, when are we? Where are we now? What's the dynamic? You know, like, I feel like I'm just always trying to, like, figure this show out. And I don't say that in a bad way, because I think what's there is actually really rich and interesting, right? I think, for instance, we rarely get a view of American wars from the other side. Like, you know, this is a thing where people complained about this. I felt complicated about it. Like, people were saying, oh, isn't it a loss that, like, Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer didn't show any of the Japanese perspective? Obviously, that was very purposeful on Nolan's part, and you can argue whether or not that is therefore a worthy POV to have. But people have been saying, you know, why didn't we see it from the Japanese perspective? We never see it from the Japanese perspective. And similarly, the Vietnam War is rarely told from the Vietnamese perspective, right? Like, we get kind of like the American perspective of it. But you kind of see America does all these things and they kind of spiral out and, like, impact all these lives in these really unpredictable ways and often horrifying ways. And so I really appreciated about that about, like, episode one, is like we're feeling kind of the dread and the urgency around the situation. We all know how it's going to end. Like, we know it's not going to, like, end well for many of these characters. But we feel that dread, and we feel, like, the impact of America's blundering into this situation they clearly have no understanding of. So, whereas episode two, it's a completely different theme. It's like this guy navigating how he is half, in his words, half Oriental, half Occidental, right? And that is kind of a proxy for him navigating the fact that he's playing multiple sides in this war. And so each episode is, like, really thematically rich. I feel like there's just so much to, like, dig into. I feel like there's so much to keep up with. So I think that's kind of why the tonal stuff works for me, is because, like, there's so much going on that I can't really focus on, like, well, it's weird that the, you know, he made this off-color joke right before he shot someone, you know, like, I can't really, I don't have time to, like, comprehend that, you know what I mean? So, well, yeah.
It's also, because would you describe it as more of a drama or a comedy?
I think it's more of a drama.
I agree. But at times it feels like you can't pin that down, right? And I think that's part of the show's strength. Part of what it is like, it's taking a subject, especially if you, like myself, like, of a largely American POV of, like, how we've contextualized this war culturally, how we talk about it, to then be dropped into, like, this POV in the show. Yeah. And it's also got yucks, like, happening, like, kind of left and right.
Right.
This isn't how we talk about what happened over there. Like, during, you know what I mean? I think there's something very deliberate going on in playing with probably, like, a hugely American audience watching this show and, like, their own uncomfortableness with how it is slotting the POV, the uses of humor. And that may be, like, I haven't read the book, but it seems like it's hewing pretty close to those tonal shifts as well in how the book was written. That all feels very deliberate. And so I think working through those feelings and why you're feeling it, sometimes, like, is this because, like, the filmmaking is odd, or is it because, like, the cultural context in which I approach this story, like, is creating friction in how it's depicted? And I've fallen more on the latter as being a deliberate choice for kind of the audience that might be watching it, like people like myself. And I find that really interesting and compelling and makes me want to see where the rest of the show goes with that tension.
I mean, this is kind of classic Park Chan-wook, though, right? Like, Old Boy, arguably one of the most upsetting movies ever made, also has a lot of jokes, right? This show, The Sympathizer, you can be having an interesting meditation on, oh, yeah, this guy, he's torn between two worlds, and he's both you know, he wants to be both like from the East and from the West. And like, wow, what kind of conflicts must this person be going through all the time? And then there's a squid scene. And that meditation is then immediately followed by that guy fucking a squid.
Oh my God. Yes.
And here's the thing. There's nothing else like it. There's, you know, no one does it like Park Chan-wook. That's the thing. It's like, no one does it like, you know, the guy who made Decision to Leave and Old Boy and Sympathy for Lady Vent. You know, like, this is a guy who's doing it like no one else. And so whether you like it or not, whether you have difficulty getting on board, I completely understand if it's not for you, but like, you cannot deny that no one's doing it like him, right? Like there's nothing else like it, right?
And the casting is really important here, right? Yeah. Because I think the show, I will say, like, Robert Downey Jr.'s character that he's playing in the second episode really tiptoes a line that I'm not sure.
It's like borderline camp, right? Like, it's...
Yeah, I don't know. Like the whole time, I'm like, am I supposed to be... As a white person, should I be laughing at this? And I don't know what the show wants me to do sometimes. But I will, like, to the show's credit, like, it's... The actors it's picked for all of its different roles, like... I mean, the main actor in particular is doing absolutely incredible work to jump between these... I just think anything less than just S-tier acting, like so much of this work, like just does not, it might not land for you personally, but I don't think it has an attempt at landing without like the caliber of acting that is like taking those words and putting them to screen, because those tonal shifts are really being sold by the actors in a lot of ways. And whether you buy it or not is like wholly on them. And I think the casting in this show is just like incredible across the board.
I agree. Sandra Oh appears in the second episode. She's delightful.
She's great.
She's wonderful, and you know, and the cast overall is great. I mean, again, this is kind of one of the, just like Shogun, another show that takes place in an Asian country. You're introduced to all these actors like you basically have never seen before, right? Or you don't know who they are, and every one of them is knocking it out of the park. I think the general is doing a pretty good job as well. Like he's kind of walking this line between an object of derision, like kind of a funny, silly character, but also clearly has a dark side to him. Mm-hmm. He's the head of secret police in Vietnam. And I suspect that we're going to see more of that character's dark side in the episodes to come. One of the other things Park Chan-wook does, aside from throwing in a bunch of tones into his stuff, is he does really cool filmmaking techniques. You know, he does not shoot shows in a boring way. Like, you know, every conversation feels like it's shot in a different way. You know, a lot of conversations like is like shot, reverse shot. But this one is like, okay, this time it's a two shot. This time it's like one shot. This time it's a shot, but we're like looking at him through like the reflection on a glass, you know, like whatever it is. He's always doing these cool transitions and interesting filmmaking things. I'm curious, did you notice any of those? Did you like that? Or did you find it distracting?
No, I didn't find it distracting. Although, it's like once you pick up on that being a filmmaking trick of his, I feel like you can distract yourself looking for them.
Yes.
And so, you know what I mean? So I don't think it's distracting on its face. I forget what it was transitioning between, but I remember the one that stood out the most in the first two episodes was when they're driving. I think they're driving in the desert and like...
And it turns like, into the porthole or the windows on a plane, right?
The windows on a plane as they're like opening up like the top of the car. And like that transition was like, because like it's just like the emotional moods, the visuals like juxtaposed against each other was just damn. Like it's not just transitions as that was stylish. It's like transitions, like using that juxtaposition, those transitions as
storytelling. To make you think about the emotions of each scene. Right.
Yes.
And how they might mix. Sometimes I do think it's a little masturbatory, but
I mean, like clearly, like he's spending a lot of time thinking. Like, look, even when they're distracting, they're cool. So
they're cool.
Got
I mean,
that going for it.
I think that's one of the complaints that I've seen about the show is that it's so stylish. It almost does a disservice to like what was actually going on in Vietnam at this time. It's like you shouldn't a story like that shouldn't be like, oh wow, look at this cool cigarette transitioning into like a flare in the sky. Like that's the wrong kind of approach to take to a story like this. I didn't much feel that because the show already has so much going on already, like tone wise, like it's already just trying to do a lot. And so it's kind of, it's what I would describe it as maximalist filmmaking, right? It's like just you're doing all the things, you're doing all the techniques. And I think you either, that approach works for you or it doesn't, but he clearly has an approach that he's trying.
Well, the filmmaker's not hiding, right? Yeah, like sometimes the filmmaker is using their skills, their talents, their stylization to purely support the story. And I mean, look, he may think he's doing that with a lot of his stylistic flourishes, but again, that's the thing of a stylistic flourish. Like it's going to land differently for different people. And I would say if the rest of the show felt like it was being comedically dismissive of the atrocities of that war, sure, maybe the cigarette to the flare stands out, but I don't think that's what's happening here. I don't think the show isn't using its comedic elements to wash away the drama and the horror of like what's occurred. It's just its way of telling this particular story.
Yeah, indeed. Any other thoughts on the first couple episodes, Patrick Klepek? I guess I wanted to give a shout out to the main character's friend who becomes catatonic after the death of his wife and child. Like it's just rare to see a depiction like that. His wife and child dies while they're fleeing Vietnam, and then he basically like stops taking care of him. So he stops like cleaning himself and becomes almost nonverbal. That was just like an interesting, compelling depiction. You just see him in the background a bunch. Like he's there, he's not saying anything. And I just thought that was like a somewhat compelling portrait of grief. I also think like the general is like really interesting because what do you do when your entire life has been dedicated to kind of fighting against this other side? And then you are then transported into a different country where you no longer have that rule, You kind of try to still live in that role, even in your new context, even though it might lead you into a terrible place, which, you know, who knows what's going to happen there. So those are some of the storylines that I thought were pretty compelling. Anything else you want to mention, Patrick Klepek?
How many characters do we know how many characters Robert Downey Jr. is playing across
four characters.
Okay. Yeah. I am fascinated to see how the rest
So far he's played like a CIA guy. And then Professor Hammer, who's like an Oriental Studies professor at this university.
Yeah, it's a fascinating choice trick of the show. I don't find it overly distracting, which was my worry when I had read about like, one of the ways this show is going to try and distinguish itself is Robert Downey Jr. is playing a bunch of different characters, which feels that that's the kind of choice that I wonder, you know, on its face, could that be distracting from the story that it's trying to tell? I haven't found that to be the case yet, but I'm curious to see how it continues to deploy him throughout the rest of the season and the roles that it assigns him.
I found it pretty distracting, I'm not gonna lie. I didn't love it, but I also appreciate this is one of the most famous humans on the planet. He just won an Oscar, and obviously has been Iron Man. Like everyone knows him as Iron Man, and he's really trying something different. And it is, in my opinion, too different. Like I did not, it's distracting, but I admire that he's trying something. And you know, many actors in his situation, they wouldn't need to do, he never needs to work again in his life. Like he can just coast off of his goodwill, but he's going out there and doing stuff, and I support it, even though it didn't work for me.
Wow.
Didn't work for me.
Well, put it on the back of the Blu-ray. Yeah. Just the praise from David Chen for Robert Downey Jr.'s performance in The Sympathizer.
All right,
he's
so
going
Klepek,
for it.
Patrick Klepek, are we going to stop covering the show, or are we going to cover it week to week? What do you think?
No, we're going to keep going.
We're going to keep going. So next week, tune in for more conversation about The Sympathizer. But those are our thoughts on the first two episodes. Overall, pretty good stuff. Patrick Klepek, before we move on, you want to let people know where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Yeah, you can find me talking about video games over at remapradio.com and a parenting and gaming newsletter over at crossplay.news.
And I just want to mention, of course, become a paid supporter at decodingtv.com to get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, as well as bonus episodes. We've gotten a lot of signups recently. I want to thank everyone who signed up recently. And my sense is that the bonus episodes are really driving a lot of the signups. People really enjoy what we're putting out there. And so Patrick and I see that, and we're going to try to figure out a bonus episode strategy that is going to make everyone happy with the stuff that we're putting out. And I just want to say thank you to all the people who have signed up recently for making that possible. DecodingTV.com, become a paid subscriber. Thanks to everyone who does that and supports this show. I also want to give a plug to A Cast of Kings, which is a Decoding TV podcast. We just recorded a bonus episode gearing up for the new season. Jesse Earle will be joining us for the new season of House of Dragons. So look forward to that and subscribe to Cast of Kings again if you haven't already. It should be a great time. Let's get to our conversation about Shogun's season finale.
Ishido-sama has mobilized to war. Toranaga will be dead in weeks.
Don't you understand? I came to your shores to use you!
The gripping finale event.
All right, it's Decoding TV. Let's talk about the season finale of Shogun. Probably series finale. My understanding is there's not going to be any new Shogun episodes. Patrick Klepek, let's start just with overall thoughts real quick. What did you think of this finale? Did Shogun stick the landing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this finale is going to put Shogun in like a rare pantheon of television show. I think it is spectacularly surprising in the way that it is unsurprising if you've been watching the show right. all along. And yet it's quiet. It's beautiful. Honestly, it feels more like an epilogue than it does actually it feels like in retrospect, the finale happened last week. And yes. here is us dealing with the consequences for the characters. Yeah. For the characters, for the region, for kind of the history of the place. And I think some scenes, I'm sure we'll get to it. And, you know, a scene in a boat might be like one of my favorite scenes in television. Certainly one of my favorite scenes and not my favorite scene in the show. It's just it's a really beautiful thing. I'm glad to have had a chance to watch it and discuss it. And I'm just so happy that the show and this version of the story exists because it was really beautiful.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you said. It subverts expectations. I think a lot of people are probably expecting some huge battle-y stuff to happen in this episode. And without spoiling too much, that's not what occurred. But yeah, I think it stuck the landing. It's an all-timer show. A lot to think about, a lot of beautiful moments, a lot of callbacks, some of which we'll talk about in this episode of the podcast. A show like Shogun is basically why a podcast like Decoding TV exists, to be able to like react to and talk about great art on TV. And it was a delight, a pleasure to engage with the show with Patrick Klepek and with all of our listeners. So thanks for listening, and it's just been wonderful. So love the finale. Let's talk about it. But before we do that, I did want to mention one thing. You know, we got a few emails about this at decodingtv@gmail.com. Why don't I read this from Scott from San Diego? Scott wrote in, "I'm writing to point out a significant part of Shogun Episode 9 that you did not cover, which is Catholicism. Mariko views suicide as a mortal sin. If she were to commit suicide, her soul would be damned to hell. She needs a second, because then her act of seppuku is not technically a suicide, since it is cutting her head off that actually kills her, and thus not a suicide. That's why she asks Lord Kiyama to be her second, because he understands disbelief as a fellow Catholic. When he doesn't show up, Blackthorn must step in, because he doesn't want her to go to hell either. This may seem like a strange belief in a technical loophole, but it does have historical precedent. In the 1600s to 1800s, there was a practice known as suicide by proxy, where a suicidal person would commit murder instead of killing themselves. They would then be tried and sentenced to execution, but before the execution, they would have the opportunity to confess and absolve themselves of their sins, end quote. So that comes in from Scott from San Diego. Yeah, we got a few emails pointing out the significance of Mariko committing suicide. That's I think it's mentioned in the episode, her Catholicism, and like why it's so important that she have a second, the importance of the second. So thanks for all the emails. At decodingtv@gmail.com. Patrick, I don't know if you had any reaction to that, but just wanted to mention it before we got started today.
No, I mean, she certainly has that scene with the priest where she has a chance to, but to the show's credit, like, it doesn't handhold you through, like, no character says out loud, "My God, if she doesn't have that confessional, her soul will be damned. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I think it's, you know, again, it's part of the beauty of the show is that it still walks you through these ideas, but doesn't feel as though it has to say them out loud, and lets the characters and their actions speak for their motivations and beliefs.
All right, let's talk about what happens in the season finale. We start with a flash forward. We are in the future with Blackthorne and his grandchildren,
?
And the grandchildren see like a bunch of his Shogun stuff. and they're like, did he use a sword to fight off Japanese assassins? We also see that Blackthorne is holding the cross that Mariko gave him. And that's all we see. I have to say, I was in shock when I saw it. I was like, what is happening? Patrick Klepek, what was your reaction to this?
Oh, we're pulling a Lost here, huh? We're doing some trickery. I didn't know what to... I sort of just chose to put it to the side. It happened. I didn't know what to make of it. It was so stylistically different, narratively different from how the show is handled.
Yeah.
We've always gone in the past. This would be an enormous jump forward.
Right.
I was like, I choose to believe this will make sense later, and I'm not going to worry about it. Sort of kept focused on the show because it didn't seem worth getting wrapped up in. Like, this is not a show. It's like, what are the implications of this narrative device that's being used? It's like, I think I'm just going to take a breather and let the show keep moving.
Yeah. And we'll talk later about whether or not the flash forward is actually a flash forward or not. Right. So anyway, back to the present day, we see the aftermath of the final scene from last week. Yabushige is waking up Blackthorne. Like, Blackthorne, it's almost like he's dreaming about this future life, or maybe future Blackthorne is dreaming about this stuff. Who knows? But he kind of says a prayer over Mariko. It's heartbreaking. You know, my wife was very upset because she had already gotten really upset that Mariko died last week, and now we have to watch her dead again this week. But you know, it's the same death. It's just showing you the aftermath, but heartbreaking scene. The regents then debate Mariko's fate. They are unhappy that Mariko was not allowed to leave because obviously this tragedy has befallen them and Torunaga has fled Edo and is preparing for war. I want to say thank you, by the way, to listener Pete, who corrected my pronunciation. It's not pronounced Edo, it's Edo, FYI. But Ishido then tries to blame Torunaga for the attack, which is ridiculous. I don't think anyone's buying that it was a false flag attack. And then he tries to deny Mariko a Christian burial, but Lady Ochiba is offended by this, and she insists that Mariko have one. Ishido is about to sign the order going to war when everything starts shaking. It's an earthquake, and Kiyama thinks it's a sign, but Ishido rams through the order anyway. Ishido and Yabushige share a moment with each other. Ishido commands Yabushige to go back to his village, Izu, but Yabushige seems to be mentally deteriorating. He starts seeing catfish in this pond that's in front of him and starts going after them. Keith Phipps in the New York Times wrote about this episode, and he described this as Yabushige's Lady Macbeth moment, where, like, in the play Lady Macbeth, she couldn't get the blood out of, you know, she couldn't get the blood off after having committed murder, and this is kind of like Yabushige. He's like damned in this way. I thought it was a very powerful moment. I mean, Yabushige, in my opinion, has been MVP of this whole season. But Patrick Klepek, any thoughts on this pair of scenes in the aftermath of Mariko's death?
Well, one, I'm just Yabushige making it all the way to the end. I've been hoping it for it since the beginning. It's like, man,
he made it eight episodes longer than we thought he would.
Yeah, this dipshit is gonna get off at some point. And so to make it as far as he did was great. He's a wonderful character foil for so many different players in this story that you understand he didn't arrive this far just because he is a wonderful comedic relief, like in a show that is otherwise like pretty deathly serious. Like the role he has to play is great. And I will say though, the concussive act of the explosion that occurs on some levels, like my man's might have a concussion, like multiple people might I don't know how people thought about brain damage, right? Like like I don't know what the medical understanding was. I mean, obviously there's a moment where Ishido asks about his hearing. And so it's like, I just don't know where in the historical medical record we're at in terms of relationships between, well, that would probably mess up your brain for at least a kind of scramble you for a couple of days. So I couldn't tell even at that point what exactly was occurring. Cause obviously Ishida leaves the scene almost thinking he's, you know, like feels bad, but like, look at this pathetic man, like this, right. This husk, this shell of a person that is left behind. Go back to where you're from and good luck with that. But it's a wonderful moment for the character, for sure.
Blackthorne is given permission to return to Toranaga's galley. The priest Alvito leaves him through the woods and reveals that the hostages have been freed because of Mariko's actions. Blackthorne was supposed to be ambushed and killed in the woods, but apparently Mariko asked the church to spare his life, and they did, for reasons that we'll find out shortly. So Yabushige and Blackthorne then return to Izu, which is Yabushige's village, and they discover Blackthorne's ship has been torched. When they arrive on shore, Omi seizes Yabushige and his swords. It seems like the Christians might have destroyed Blackthorne's ship. Blackthorne says, Christians did this? Mariko-sama? Anyway, they're looking for the people who did this horrific crime of burning the ship. And we see that they're really beating up a bunch of villagers to find these people, torturing some people, putting heads on pikes. It's a bad scene. It's a bad scene in the village since Toranaga got back and, the ship was burned down. So, Yabushige then appears before Toranaga. It's the same setting as the first episode of the show, where Yabushige was sitting there and Blackthorne was in front of him. But now it's Yabushige begging for his life. Yabushige confesses. He's ordered to commit seppuku. He asks for Blackthorne to be his second, but he's denied. And then he asks Toranaga, who agrees. All right, let's pause here and talk about all these scenes from Izu. Any reaction to this stuff? I just thought, this show is incredibly poetic. There's a lot of callbacks. There's a lot of references to stuff that happened earlier. A lot of symmetry, right? And so that is going to be one of the moments, I think, is like Yabushige now begging for his life. Blackthorne wasn't begging for his life. He's a little bit more recalcitrant than that. But like, just the idea that, oh, the person who is, the master has become the supplicant, basically. And I thought that was a powerful moment. But any other reactions to this set of scenes, Patrick Klepek?
Well, I mean, one of the things that really stood out for me, and especially during that like, kind of camera pan over the heads on pikes, yeah, on sticks, is, one thing that's been fascinating about the back half of this season has been not just the deconstruction of like the myth of Toranaga, but as we get to throughout this episode in its entirety and like kind of where it leaves that character is the full picture of Toranaga, like the viciousness, the calculation,
yes,
the violence. This is not a hero. The definition of what is a hero in this, kind of era with all, like we can get into like where things stand by the end, but the Toranaga we were presented with at the beginning of the show, you wouldn't have guessed he's the kind of person who would be ripping through the town, torturing, killing, beheading, like psychologically traumatizing folks in order to achieve this end. And that's the character we have, like at the end of this story, yeah, as we're also going through what's the masterstroke, what's the plan. And you have that kind of set up next, someone committing these horrifically vile acts against people that otherwise you'd imagine to be loyal to him. And I found that to be really compelling because it leaves Toranaga as this, I don't know who this guy is anymore. And I mm-hmm. don't know what he will do, what he's capable of. And I don't know where his charm offensive, which is like something we've seen many times throughout the show, I don't know what's performative anymore. I don't right. know who this guy is. And the show is about to end. And that is just a really interesting place to be with, I don't know, if not the main character, certainly one of the three main characters yeah. of the yeah. show.
It's purposefully vague about Toranaga's true nature, right? The show is, I think. And we'll talk a little bit more about like, I have some thoughts about the real life events that this is based off of and what the show is trying to say there. So let's talk about that in a little bit. But I agree with you that there's a viciousness to Toranaga that like we've seen glimpses of and comes into full display here in the final episode. Anyway, Blackthorn returns to his house, and Blackthorn and Fuji share a nice moment together. All the stuff about missing Mariko is very powerful. You know, when Blackthorn gets on the boat after Priest Alvito tells him, like, Mariko traded your life and saved your life. And, you know, when he says, no translator, you know, when him and Fuji are sitting horrible. On the porch, it's very emotional. It's very emotional. And Blackthorn and Fuji also discuss, like, Fuji's family's remains and, you know, what's going to happen with them. Fuji reveals that her commitment to Blackthorn is complete and she'll be becoming a nun. We also learn that, again, as I mentioned, they're murdering a lot of people who allegedly torched the Blackthorn's ship, and Blackthorn gets really upset about this and asks for a meeting with Toranaga. All right. Let's talk about the Blackthorn-Fuji relationship. I think this was such a good relationship. I just wish the show had been longer. Like,
yeah.
I wish we'd gotten this. I don't know how they could have done it. Could they have spread this story out over two seasons? I don't think so. I don't think it would have really made sense. But the Blackthorn-Fuji relationship is so compelling. This idea, like, all the women in the show get a lot of agency and inner life. And the Blackthorn-Fuji relationship is compelling because obviously this is a woman who starts out fucking hating this guy. And like, then by the end, they have this mutual respect. And that's a really compelling story. And everything we see of it is really interesting. And I just wish we'd seen a little bit more of it. But obviously a great performance, a great character. Any other thoughts on Lady Fuji? Because I think, you know, there's another scene at the end we'll talk about. But like, this is kind of the bulk of how the relationship wraps up. And she's like, hey, guess what? I'm done. I don't need to help you anymore. And I think she's not broken up about it. She's much less broken about it than Blackthorn is. But I think by the end, they do have this connection that's really interesting. What do you think, Patrick?
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't know where they put it, right? Like, it feels such a thoughtfully scripted show with like just very little fat. And it's like, sure, would I like to have been in this place longer? Yes. Could the story justify that? I don't know. Like, I've had so much
maybe
trust
if it had been
in
like 13 episodes instead of 10, that would have been great. But this is not necessarily an insult. It's just like,
no, it's a testament to our, like, sadness over,
yeah,
it,
yeah,
being,
it's like, oh,
it,
this is so good.
And,
yeah.
And I do think actually it's a testament to both the acting for Blackthorn and Fuji, and also just how much they get out of how little you are seen. That is that, like, I think by the end, when we arrive at these scenes, we are meant to sort of just assume, so like, a lot of their relationship has developed kind of off screen. Like, we pick up on bits and pieces,
right,
of it,
yeah,
over the, like, the stuff with Fuji often occurs next to other scenes that like Blackthorn or Mariko was involved in. We sort of just see an evolution of their relationship over time. It's rare that we're getting a lot of one-on-one or just moments in the household where you kind of see that relationship change and develop. And yet, despite the fact that that relationship, which has one of the most powerful conclusions in the show, is the one that has some of the most minimal like screen time, and the fact that it lands is really effective use of the time that those characters did have. I think it's a really incredible acting. I think Cosmo Jarvis gives like his best performance of the season. He's also given the most opportunity to have emotional range in this episode in particular, and I think the two of them land that exceptionally well. And I think it's, again, I think it's a feeling you have throughout the show, which is, as you can see, you know, I don't know if you did this, but like multiple times I would pause and be like, oh, that's all this. At first it was, how are they going to fit the big battle?
Right, yeah, I was
in?
Like, how are they going to wrap all this up in 15 minutes? You know, that was,
right.
That
and
was
then
something
as,
I thought, yeah.
As, you know, as one does in a show that you is coming to a real sense of finality, you realize like, oh, that's the last, like, those characters are just never going to see each other again.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And I think part of what you're getting at is almost a nostalgia for like characters that you've said goodbye to.
Right.
And did they need more time? Probably not. Even if it would have been fine, or it would have been good. I don't know if it would have been beneficial. And I think that's part of, I don't mean to over exaggerate, but like the grieving process of watching like a good story come to an end. I'm like, but wouldn't it have been great if? And it's like, well, did it need it? Like, the reason I'm upset about it is because they gave me what I needed.
It leaves you wanting more, you know, that's a compliment you can say for a show. All right. There's a quick scene where Toranaga meets his new son. He expresses,
oh my God, that's brutal. Like, well, I got another one of these. Thanks. Like, Jesus.
Well, he's like, oh, we were so sad about your other son that died. And he's like, well, I always got more.
There are a lot of lines that Toranaga delivers cold. He does that one with a laugh. And it was one of the most despicable lines that comes out of his mouth. Like, I got kids and everything, so maybe it hits a little hard. But I was like, I cannot believe, like, that's, like, I don't know. Like, that one, I was just like, he's Sonny, fuck you.
Like, he's such a dick. Anyway, we also learned that Ochiba has sent a secret message to Toranaga. It's like a poem, but it also has some other information on it. My wife was pointing out, boy, there are a lot of little messages written on little papers in this episode, right? This is the little papers get a ton of action that they're pulling out of shirts and handing them to people. Anyway, there's really two big scenes in this episode, right? Two main centerpiece scenes. And one of them is Blackthorn and Toranaga. So Blackthorn appears before Toranaga and he wants to tell him what's going, you know, he wants to say, stop torturing the people of Ajiro. And the fisherman is translating for them. And then Akinao, right? Akinao is the guy's name.
The fisherman.
Tonomoto Akinao. I apologize for messing that up. Yep. He starts translating and he's like, wait, I don't know if it's going to be plausible that I know how to translate this shit. And then he explains that he is actually a double agent who was a samurai ordered to convert to the religion of the Portuguese and learn their language to spy on behalf of Toranaga. Pretty freaking badass, I have to say. Like, badass revelation, badass way in which it's revealed. Anyway, very cool. That's just like a whole other epic journey that guy went on. We didn't even see on screen, really, pretty much. So,
mm-mm.
Blackthorn then apologizes for disrespecting Toranaga because in a previous episode, he basically said, yo, Toranaga, it's not cool that you gave up. You know, very, very uncool. And he's like, he didn't realize that Toranaga hadn't given up at all during that time. So he also asks Toranaga to leave the village alone, believing it was Mariko that traded the ship for Blackthorn's life. Toranaga refuses, and Blackthorn escalates, saying, you know, confessing, like, hey, I was using you this whole time. I'm the enemy. I'm the one you want to torture, not these village people. And then he says he's going to commit seppuku. And he takes the blade out, and he's about to do it when Toranaga stops him and says, if you're finally done, rebuild that ship and make me a fleet. I do want to just acknowledge that Blackthorn has gone on an incredible journey in the last 10 episodes. Yeah. From like, fuck these barbarians. Like, we have nothing in common. They're savages that have no knowledge. Like, now he's fully embracing the seppuku life.
The only way to experience a proper death is for my intestines to spill out. And now I won't even have a second.
Right, exactly. I'm just doing this. I'm doing this solo, baby. It's a great scene, and it's given much more context by what happens later on, right? So I don't even know if we should talk about this scene until we talk about what happens later.
Yeah.
But like, all right. So, but essentially, Toranaga is like accepts Blackthorn's confession. He's like, okay, okay, I'm gonna stop torturing the people. That's fine. And there is a shot in this episode. There's a shot in the season finale of Shogun that is hilarious, in my opinion, where they have all these heads on pikes and they're taking in the heads. It reminded me of like a Hallmark movie where they like, it's Christmas is over and they're like taking in the wreaths and shit. Like, it's like, oh, okay, like the torture is over, so we can take the heads off the pikes now. I just thought that was hilarious. Okay. Anyway, Yabushige and his nephew wander out to the woods. They have a final nice moment where Yabushige says, you know, you're the nephew that I, or the son that I never had. But he also writes a final poem that he gives to his nephew. He says, my dead body, don't burn it, don't bury it, just leave it in a field, and with it, fill the belly of some hungry dog. End quote. some of Yabushige's finest work, according to him.
So, God, that killed me.
Yeah, that was amazing. A spectacular comic relief for the show right up to the very end. Okay. Yabushige and Toranaga have one final meeting. Toranaga reveals to Yabushige he was the one that burned Blackthorn's ship. It was a necessary ruse to test Blackthorn. And it was all worth it, torturing and killing all those people just to get Blackthorn on his side.
It's a little over the top. Toranaga,
it's a little much, isn't it, Toranaga? It's
a little hat on a hat.
Did you really need to do the whole heads on pikes thing? You know, was that really necessary, Toranaga?
Could it have been one head? Did it have to be three heads? You know, what's the line here?
But this goes to your earlier point about, like, Toranaga is kind of a piece of shit, right? Like, torturing these presumably innocent people, right? Like, to do a loyalty test for Blackthorn? Like, there's no other way to do that?
Right.
You know? But, yeah, I mean, Toranaga, he's not one for half measures, as they say, you know? So,
yes.
There is an interesting line, you know, how does it feel to shape the wind to your will? I don't control the wind. I only study it. Beautiful. I think it's very, very interesting. It kind of says a lot about Toranaga's character. Like, mm-hmm. he's not this mastermind pulling all the strings. He's just like, I see where things are blowing and I go that way. Like, that's kind of what he's saying. And I'll talk more about how this compares to real life in a moment, but. Toranaga also reveals that last week, the episode titled Crimson Sky, that was Crimson Sky, Patrick Klepek. Crimson Sky is already done. Toranaga says with the Regents united, he could never send his army to Osaka. So he, quote, sent a woman to do what an army never could, end quote. We see a vision of the future. Toranaga foresees meeting his enemies on the field of battle. However, because of Mariko's actions, Lady Ochiba has grown tired of her alliance with Ishido. In the letter we saw earlier, she secretly pledged to keep the heir's army from the battlefield. Ishido will have no banner. The regents will turn on him. He's basically dead regent walking right now. And then Toranaga says, I will start it in Edo, my center of power, a nation without war is an era of great peace. All of us have made this possible. You, me, Lady Mariko, even the barbarian who came out of the sea. And then Yabushige asks Toranaga to reveal whether he wanted to be shogun all along. Whether he was as ambitious as the rest of us. Toranaga refuses to say anything, and Yabushige then commits seppuku. There is this line where he says, why tell a dead man the future? That is the same line that Yabushige says about Toranaga in the first episode. When they're like, should we tell Toranaga about Blackthorn ships and weapons? Why tell a dead man the future? Well, turnabout is fair play, Yabushige. And then Yabushige commits seppuku and dies. A lot to unpack here, Patrick Klepek. I will start by saying that it is very cool. The concept of Mariko could do what an army couldn't, very cool. And the show earns it. You know, the show delivered, like, the show built up Mariko into this really cool character. And the way last episode played out was very, very satisfying. No complaints. But I have to say that the vision of the future and, like, oh, Toranaga is going to win by default. Does feel a little bit super easy, barely an inconvenience to me, in the sense that, like, every single step of this process has been so strained and so deliberate, and then it's kind of like for the show then to be like, hey, fast forward, like, it's all gonna just work out, like, don't worry about it, it's all gonna work out. That did feel a little bit, just a tiny bit, you know, like, a pretty convenient way to wrap that up. Patrick Klepek, you have that reaction? What'd you think?
I think that's one way of interpreting it. I think the other is vision of the
future.
That's one
wrong way of viewing it.
No, but that's Toranaga's sense of self, right? Like, I took that less of this is exactly how it will play out as much as this is what this is Toranaga's headspace. Like, this is a character vision, that we very rarely get to see any interiority. Mm-hmm, and he is now doing something he never does in the show because he's about to kill, you know, this character. It's like, I will map out to you what I did, how I did it, why I did it, and what's going to come next in a way that is usually just kept to himself. And so I don't know. I think, and we'll get into this in where the show ends, I think there is ambiguity left on the table as to whether that's exactly how thing plays out. But that is how he envisions it to play out. But I also am with, I could also deeply sympathize with the interpretation of the show has the story it's telling. It will not extend as far as this sequence. And so this is its way of showing a version of that sequence without actually getting us to there on the timeline. And you can view it as a kind of flash forward as opposed to kind of a theory of the case. But I don't know. I took it more of a theory of the case and is a show of Torunaga's own arrogance as much as his personal calculations.
I mean, that's fair. That's fair that it does a character building, but I think it's time to get into the real life events that this is based off of. So okay. I have not looked at this until I saw the finale because I didn't want to quote unquote spoil myself on real life events.
Yeah.
But the show Shogun is based off of actual characters and actual events that took place in Japanese history. And you'll find some articles about this. I found IndieWire's to be particularly good. But I'm just going to read a little bit from this IndieWire piece, right? And you know, Patrick Klepek, the whole time I've been reading recaps of the show while we've been talking about it, everyone has been saying the title of the show is a spoiler. I mean, the title of the show is, I think you've been unaware of that. And so I have kept that from you, Patrick Klepek. I've wanted to say, hey, Patrick, it's all going to work out to have Shogun because of the title. But I didn't say it. And now I get to say it because we're at the end of the show. But Shogun is a fictional take, quoting here from the IndieWire piece, on the early 17th century power struggle that in real life led to Lord Tokugawa Ieyasu founding the Tokugawa Shogunate, a dynastic military government that ruled over Japan from 1603 to 1868. The Shogunate emerged after a period of political turmoil that saw Japan's feudal lords united under the banner of samurai Lord Oda Nobunaga, only to see Lord Oda murdered by one of his old men. So it's like the setup is very similar to what happened in real life. The setup for Shogun copies these exact beats from history, but gives the main players different names, which gives the author, Clavell, enough narrative deniability to stick to history when he feels like it, but otherwise go nuts with quasi-historical intrigue. So in the Clavell dimension, Tokugawa is called Torunaga, and Ishida is called Ishido. Not very creative with the name change there. Anyway, yeah. But the idea, Patrick, is that like this, the events we see depicted essentially ushered in this major era of Japan's history that was widely regarded as productive and peaceful, right? And I think the question the show proposes, poses to us is it worth it, right? Like, is it worth it that, like, Torunaga is such an asshole? He's killing off innocent people. He's sacrificing Mariko. He's sacrificing his friend. To get to this point of the shogunate rule, you know, is it worth it? Or, you know, put a different way, often the things that we think of as, like, a peaceful and prosperous time were founded on, like, you know, a lot of blood was necessary to be spilt to kind of create these eras. I think that's ultimately what the show is trying to say. But of course, because it's not based on real life people, you know, it has it takes a lot of liberties with the creation. So now hearing that, Patrick Klepek, does that recontextualize how you think of the show at all or this episode?
Yeah. And it makes it fascinating because, in some ways, knowing the real life history betrays some of the intrigue of the show, like knowing that what it's based on broadly did lead to like an era of peace and prosperity. Yeah, I guess those couple heads on a spike were like probably fine. Seems like a lot worked out really well.
That's what Torunaga thinks. That's what Torunaga thinks. He's like, hey, it was worth sacrificing all these people because we're going to get to the end game, right?
Yeah. He thinks that, but you don't get to see it. Right. Like it is all based on like what
But we as a viewer know it led to that. Right.
Right.
As
well. I didn't know that till you told me. Right. But that's what I guess what I'm saying is unawares, which I think is going to be the vast majority of the people that watch this show.
Sure. True.
Will not understand like what occurs next. It's not as though this show very easily could have had some text at the end that like sort of gives you a sense of like the historical background, like what it led. It could have adapted real life history and like, and then it went on and everything was, it was an era of peace.
Right. It didn't give this text on screen and like have the side by side of Torunaga and the guy he's based off of. Right. It didn't do that. Right.
Yeah. No. And where it leaves you is, I don't know. Seems like he could have gone to war. A lot more blood could have been shed. His creativity, the sacrifices that were made do seem to have avoided much more catastrophic and societal violence. Do those like ends justify the means? We don't get to see the ends. And so all we're left with is, what do you make of Torunaga? What kind of ruler would he be? And would that actually lead to peace? And so that's part of what makes the show where it ends. If you aren't, you know, aware of kind of like where it leads, much more ambiguous than I think how you might feel if you know its historical connections. Like, yeah, it actually was like, it turned out pretty good after that.
Well, I think knowing it turned out pretty good actually raises even more interesting questions about like the show. Like, was it worth it? Is it, you know, and also like the show saying, hey, yeah, it's all founded on blood. And does that mean it's all a fiction? Does that mean our notions of justice and peace are a fiction? You know, like I think it's kind of interesting. I also think the approach is just interesting. Like, imagine if it was like they gave George Washington and Thomas Jefferson like different names. They called him Max Washington and George, you know, Jeffersonians or something. Like, you know, they had these, and then like showed like the terrible things they had to do. And then it ends with, well, hope America works out. You know, like that's kind of similarly like what that would be like if it was in another country. Like, I put a different way, like for Japan, like everyone knows about this, right? Everyone knows like kind of what this is. But if you're in a different country, you might not. And similarly, if you're in a different country from America, you might not know like who the critical people were in founding America. And like, and TBD, by the way, still jury's out on whether the American experiment was a good idea. So anyway, I the real life connections are interesting. Also, Blackthorne was actually like a real dude. There was like a real life Blackthorne. I don't think he was quite as integral to the plot as he was in the show. And there was a person that Mariko was based off of who actually was a translator. But in real life, Mariko and Blackthorne, the real life Mariko and real life Blackthorne never actually met. So no love story. Sorry to disappoint you. Anyway, I'd recommend you read this IndieWire piece, and there's a bunch of other pieces on the internet, but I found it illuminating. I wanted to save it until after I'd seen the finale before like learning all the connections. So there are a couple of final scenes in this episode. We see Blackthorne and Fuji dispose of the ashes. Very moving scene. She says, you know, he's about to throw the cross into the ocean. And I think she says the words like, let your hands be the last to hold her, which was a callback to the first episode, I think the first episode of the show, where Fuji's husband and child are about to be killed. And Mariko intervenes and says, like, let your hands be the last to hold her. You know, she says to the guards, let her hands be the last to hold her son. That's what Mariko says to the guards. And then so then there's a symmetry there where Fuji says, let your hands be the last to hold her. Blackthorne holds the cross, drops it into the ocean. And I have to say that was a shocking moment because it quote unquote proves ! That the flash forward was not real. What do you think, Patrick Lepik? Was present day Blackthorne dreaming of old Blackthorne, or and that was like a vision that never actually happened, or was old Blackthorne actually there and dreaming of past Blackthorne?
Yeah, I don't. I took the dropping of the cross into the water to be that you should not take the framing device as an actual flash forward. Like, I mean, the title of the episode is Dream Within a Dream. And I think that is I think you should take that part literally. Is like, it is a dream of something that is not going to occur for Blackthorne. I think that is even more underscored when we'll get to it, you know, when Torunaga has a line later, is like, I don't think that Blackthorne is ever going to leave Japan. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that is that's where I took it to mean that is merely a dream of his, that like he went back, had a life in England, and his lot in life is going to be, you know, a vassal for Lord Torunaga going forward.
It was a really cool moment, I have to say. Like, because the show doesn't call it out. Like, the show isn't like, by the way, remember he was holding a cross in the flash forward? You know, like, it's just like, oh, it's, it lets you put it together. The episode title, by the way, is a callback to episode 2 of the show, I believe, when the Tycho dies. And he says, quote, so strange this life, just a dream of a dream, end quote. And, you know, there's many ways to interpret it, right? But, like, apparently in the book, Yabushige says the phrase, what is life but an escape from death? That is kind of, if you think about it, Patrick Klepek, we spend most of time either not existing or being dead. and life
damn,
is
damn, when
of
you
this...
put it that way, David.
We spend millions of years either not existing or being dead. And so, really, we just kind of... like our lives are just a little blip, like it's a little dream, you know. And it's kind of like, what is life but a dream of a dream? Like we're kind of like, if we spend most of our time in this other state, then life is really just kind of this. Oh, it's when you have we've all had a dream within a dream where you're like you wake up and you're still dreaming, you know. And it's kind of like, yeah, it's a thing where like it barely was a thing that you can comprehend or that happened. And I think the whether or not Blackthorne had a flash forward, it kind of plays with that idea, is like, you know, it's just maybe it was a flash forward, maybe it wasn't, who knows. I think you're right though. I don't think it was a flash forward. I think he was just dreaming about the future and this life that he's never gonna lead. So
well, and then also, you know, I think viewed a different way, like the gripping of Mariko's cross, like he will never get over that. Like that will be like the loss of her is going to be a defining event that burdens him for as long as he lives, for as long as he's here or there. Like that, even if he was to leave,
even if
he was to, he's got kids, you know, or grandkids, like he's remarried, he creates this whole new history for himself, you know, back home, like quote home where his heart died, like in Japan, like when Mariko died. And so like, is it really a dream? If he leaves, builds this life, which is mostly a myth, because on his in his dying breaths, all he does is think about her.
Yeah, great point. I want to, by the way, mention that there is a user on X called Clone Humor that made a list of all the callbacks from the season finale. I've mentioned a lot of them, but they have a great list on their X/Twitter account that lists a bunch of them. So, and there's one final scene, Patrick Klepek, where Buntaro shows up. You know, Blackthorne's trying to get his old busted ass ship out of the water. Buntaro shows up and offers to help Blackthorne drag his ship to shore, and they kind of have a nice little moment together before the show kind of it sees Toranaga contemplating the future, and then the show ends. And that's it. That's all the show. Which is kind of a weird place to end the show, I thought. Like, but you know. Whatevs. I not weird. That's too strong. But just as like, oh, it's. Let me put it this way. I think this episode delivered a lot of stuff that I wasn't anticipating, but everything it delivered was great. Like, it's a very Fuji heavy episode. You know, for all the Fuji that we get prior to now, and the Fuji stuff is wonderful. But it's like. When I was going in, I wasn't like, I really hope they resolve the Fuji Blackthorne stuff. You know what I mean? Like, that was not what I was hoping going in. And you know, I hope Blackthorne and Buntaro make up, you know, like that's not what I was hoping going in, but it did give us those things. And I think those things were very lovely. The thing that I like most about this show is showing that, you know, what I find interesting, Patrick Klepek, is like, there actually wasn't that much action in the show, right? There, in fact, there was one episode, I think it was episode 2 or 3, that had a ton of action. And I think we all think that was like the weakest episode, right? Like, and the action was fine, you know, and there was Mariko did some cool stuff last episode as well. But what this show demonstrates is like the show's action does not need to be its strong point. Like, you can still be extremely exciting, gripping, suspenseful. Just having characters that have rich backstories, that have emotional stakes invested in what's happening, and that will make us as the audience invest as well. And like, it's again, it's one woman could do what an army couldn't. That is not just a statement about Crimson Sky, that is a statement about television and dramatic you know, filmmaking, right? Is like one person's fate can do what a whole army can't do. And I think a lot of people can take that lesson away from Shogun. Any other thoughts on the end of the show, Patrick Klepek?
No, I mean, I hope it lands for everyone else the way it landed, like it sounds like for you and I, where this is a show that it didn't give me what I wanted, but it gave me what I needed. And and that's that's tough, right? Like a lot of times the way stories themselves set themselves up is you spend two thirds of it creating expectations and then you deliver on that expectation, maybe in a surprising way, but you sort of know where, like where you're headed. And here, like that final shot, it's a beautiful final shot. It feels very concluding for the story that it was telling.
Yeah.
But if we were to have sitting, you know, at multiple times throughout this show, if you and I were to make evolving bets on how it's going to end, what are going to be some of the major beats, you know, how many times at the end of, you know, like 7, 8, 9, like, all right, that was a pretty quiet episode. But next episode, like shit is going to hit the fan. And it just never happened. And it was just not that kind of show. And
well, it did happen. It just didn't happen in the way we thought it would. It didn't happen with like an epic battle with like hundreds of extras.
Right.
But it did happen in the sense that, you know, obviously last episode was very consequential for Mariko, right? And so
yes. And so and I go ahead.
Well, I was going to say I think that's the biggest achievement of the show is the character of Mariko. Like just making that making this one character who you as an audience become so invested in. That like when she dies, it's like a massive loss, right? Like it, you feel it. It's hard to make characters like that. It's hard to create a character where like you root for them so much and you become so invested in their fate that like the whole show hinges on them. But yeah, huge
and to do so
there.
In a single season, right? Like some of what, you know, if you're especially in the mode of television, in the format of television, the audience can forgive. Like they know they're probably going on a long journey. Like TV, most shows are not a limited series. Most shows are multiple seasons, often longer than the ten episodes we have here. Maybe less so in this era of television. But so you're like, oh, there's more. Like this show had to be so economical with its character development, its storytelling, because assuming that we don't get anything after, even if we do, even in some world where they try to conceive of another storyline that picks up here or an anthology, whatever the case may be. You never get the sense in this show they were saving anything. Like if they were to do anything, it would be like it wasn't at the expense of the story that was told here. And I think that's incredibly hard to do, to make you care that much about so many different, in such a show with so many different characters. It is not as though this is the Toranaga show. This is the Mariko show. Like it, like at multiple times, it feels like these characters are the lead. It is a truly ensemble cast in like the highest compliment with like the highest degree of difficulty to get you to care about that many characters in that role. And I think that's a huge testament to what the show pulls off.
Completely agreed. And yeah, it's a show where, you know, we talked a little bit about white savior tropes, right, on the show. I think there were some white savior tropey things, but like overall, not really, you know, because Blackthorn is a pawn in Toranaga's game. And so the romance between Blackthorn and Mariko, kind of a well-worn trope at this point. But that's how good the show is it made me overlook that, you know, that is a very warmed over concept that is used frequently. Yeah, at the end of the day, I think Mariko is a character, but also, yeah, Toranaga, Blackthorn, Yabushige, like these are the characters that really like Yabushige to a much lesser extent, but like these are the characters that like got me through the show. And we just also have to acknowledge Patrick Klepek, man, really bold to make a show where 80 to 90% of the dialogue is not in English. I mean, that's just like an American show for American audiences. It's just like, still can't believe they did it. It's a miracle that it happened. And it worked wonderfully. And not only that, but the way they use translation as a storytelling device is like some unlike anything I've ever seen before, you know, in the way that Mariko's translating was like such a key part of that character and how she related with the other characters in each scene. So many good things about the show. So many good things to say. So anyway, anything else? If not, I think we can wrap it up there. We close the book on our Shogun conversation.
Last thing I would ask, if the show has been a huge success, obviously in a lot of the like the follow-up interviews with the showrunners, with the family of the author, they are leaving themselves some wiggle room on like what happens after here, whether like, what do you think happens with this world, with these showrunners, like in the wake of the massive, I don't know how to qualify massive necessarily. Like, I don't know how FX looks at it necessarily, but it feels like it was a big show. It was a success. The natural inclination here would be more. Like, I know what we probably want to happen, which is leave it as it is. Like, find some other story to tell if you want these creatives. But what do you think happens in the wake of Shogun?
Well, the creators of the show have given an interview to Hollywood Reporter. The question was asked, here's the inevitable season two question. Is it going to happen? Justin Mark says, I don't know. I keep saying it's like we want to let everyone be on the same page when it comes to the book. And hopefully now the TV audience and the book audience are on the same page and with what the story is and where it resolves. I think if we had a story, if we could find a story, we would be open to it. But I don't think that anyone ever wants to be out over their skis without a roadmap and everything. And it's also just about, do people want more of it? And then the interviewer says, yes, the answer is yes. But it's also about not even topping the book, but how do you even equal the roadmap that Clavell laid out? And I don't know if it's possible. I don't know if Clavell could have done it either. That's probably why he moved on to other books. He knew what he had done. Yeah, it's a tough one, end quote. So, yeah, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, this would be making a season two of Shogun would be like making Old Boy and then trying to remake it as a TV series. Why would you do that? Why would you mess with a masterpiece like that? But yeah, we'll see. Stranger things have happened. We got Big Little Lies season two, right? So, you know, anything's possible in the post Big Little Lies season two universe. So
that's right. As we're always saying, hallmark touchstone of this show.
Yeah. But Patrick Klepek, it sounds like you would want to see more season two of Shogun, right?
I don't think I would want to see a continuation of the story. I'd love to see these creatives work together again on a story and whatever that is, whether it was historical in nature or something else. But, like the people that put this together show was something special. If they told me they wanted to do a Shogun season two, you and I would be recapping that 2.5 years from now.
Absolutely.
We would.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I would just have faith that they found something that was worth telling, but gosh, it's just hard for me to imagine picking up where this ended and having something equally compelling to say. That seems like an impossible task. And yeah. I hope they don't try it.
All right. I want to say thank you to Patrick Klepek for joining me for this journey. I want to say thank you to our listeners at Decoding TV Podcast. If you're watching this on YouTube, a lot of people have just watched our recaps on YouTube. Thanks for watching. You can listen to the podcast version of this wherever your podcast can be found, Decoding TV. And thanks to all the paid members at decodingtv.com who make this podcast possible. That is the end of our coverage of Shogun. It's the end of this episode of Decoding TV. He is Patrick Klepek. I am David Chen. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. The Sympathizer and Fallout Season 1 will be covered on next week's episode of Decoding TV. Until then, goodbye.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.